Welcome to the Allowed Podcast. I'm Louise Steinman, curator of the Allowed series, presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. Allowed is a series of dynamic lectures, readings, performances, and discussions that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic Downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. To learn more about Allowed and learn how you can help the Library Foundation of Los Angeles support the Los Angeles Public Library, please go to our website, www.alloudla.org. The Allowed program you're about to hear was produced in 2009. John Adams is one of America's most admired and respected composers. As a conductor, he's appeared with the world's greatest orchestras, including in recent seasons, the London Symphony Orchestra, the Los Angeles Philharmonic, and New York Philharmonic, and with orchestras in Atlanta, Stockholm, San Francisco, and Detroit. From 2003 to 2007, he was composer in residence at Carnegie Hall and conducted the first public concert in Carnegie's new space, Zankel Hall. His original operatic works include Nixon in China, The Death of Klinghoffer, and Dr. Atomic, and on the Transmigration of Souls, which received the 2003 Pulitzer Prize for Music and won a rare triple crown of Grammy Awards, Best Classical Recording, Best Orchestral Performance, and Best Classical Contemporary Composition. His wonderful book, Hallelujah Junction, which I recommend heartily, it's really beautiful, which he'll discuss tonight, is part memoir and part description of the creative process. Adams traces his musical lineage back to the era of the swing bands and to his grandfather's New Hampshire dance hall, where his clarinetist father met his jazz singer mother and eloped to marry and eke out a meager living during the Great Depression. He evokes his New England boyhood with its marching bands and small-town orchestras, and he details his cross-continental journey to California, where he first worked for minimum wage in a drafty Oakland warehouse, unloading cheap clothing from Asia for American department stores. He writes, "I personally handled most of the Bermuda shorts worn by Richard Nixon's silent majority during the summer of 1972. He details friendships with other composers, choreographers, and visual artists, including the young Peter Sellers, that very rare spirit whom he aptly describes as an intensely serious and sophisticated artist with the moral zeal of an abolitionist. And I'm sure as many of you know and hopefully are going to be able to attend tonight, tomorrow night and Saturday, John Adams will be at Disney Hall conducting A Flowering Tree, his fourth opera collaboration with Peter Sellers. The Boston Globe critic David Rollo wrote that this is a book that any aspiring artist in any medium should read as a kind of how-to guide to achieving artistic success without losing integrity, something that seems to many young artists today merely impossible. In fact, it is a book for anyone who wants to create something, including a self, which I think is pretty high praise. In one lively section of Hallelujah Junction, Adams describes how, in the late 70s, he created the contemporary music series in San Francisco known as New and Unusual Music for the San Francisco Symphony, which he calls which became a cause célèbre among the San Francisco alternative community. This series was produced, he notes in the book, by a then-recent hire at the San Francisco Symphony, the dynamic young Deborah Borda. Well, tonight we are honored to have Deborah Borda here to interview John Adams. As most of you probably know, Deborah is president and chief executive officer of the Los Angeles Philharmonic Association, responsible for managing all artistic, administrative, and technical operations of the Philharmonic at Disney Hall and the Hollywood Bowl, as well as the presentation of close to 300 concerts annually. She came to Los Angeles after a decade as the executive director of the New York Philharmonic, where she served as the first woman in recent history to manage a major American symphony orchestra. It is a great honor to welcome John Adams and Deborah Borda to the Los Angeles Public Library.
Welcome, everybody. We're at the almost at the apex right now this week of a John Adams intensive, sort of a building crescendo. We started last week with a little Vorspeis, and that was in our subscription program. We did the chairman dances, and I was sitting with John during the concert, and I think you said you hadn't heard the piece in
10 years, maybe.
10 years. So it went pretty well, though. He seemed to like it, so that was good. The audience did as well. On Tuesday night, he conducted a concert of our Green Umbrella series, and it was quintessential John in a very specific way, and that is that over the years in working with him and knowing him, he has been such a guide star for us in terms of the identification of really blistering new talent, really exciting young people, people who are on the verge of what the new creativity will be and can be. And so in his program, the three pieces he performed first were by two wonderful young composers, Timothy Andres and then Peyton MacDonald. And at the end of that, of course, there was the work of the old master, and John conducted a riveting performance of his Son of Chamber Symphony. Tomorrow night is his opera, Flowering Tree, which is a fully staged opera, which is directed by his close collaborator for many years, who you will read about quite a bit in the book, Peter Sellars. And actually, the crescendo continues next year when John becomes the creative chair. It was Gustavo Dudamel's first appointment. And I was just saying to John as we were walking over here, when I write my book, maybe one of the things that I'll put into it is the day that Gustavo asked John to become creative chair, and it would be his first appointment, and we were sitting at the lunch table, and Gustavo just became sort of more and more wide-eyed as he realized he was sitting there with John Adams, and we're waiting for him to pop the question. So finally, we get John to get up and go to the men's room, and we say to Gustavo's wife, Ello, come on, help us. So we go, now, when he comes back, ask him. So comes back, he sits down. Again, Gustavo doesn't talk, and then Ello gave him a kick under the table, and he became creative chair. But we'll talk more about that post later on. You know, John, this is such a pleasurable read, the book. It's not only wonderfully written, but it's, to me, a very sort of stimulating and endearing combination of setting real-life events, in the context of challenges that artists face both internally as well as externally. The challenges have to do with very technical things. Sometimes they often have to do with people. And one of the parts that I read was about the world premiere of El Nino, and I know some of the story from different people who were there, and I just wished I had been backstage, and you start to open that curtain. He actually describes how he composes in this book. And that's something we'll talk about, because that is something that is very mysterious, I think, for many of us. And the book poses some real philosophical and human questions, and that, of course, leads me to my first question. The subtitle of the book is Composing an American Life. And as Louise said, John emerges from a real East Coast foundation, marching bands, music hall in New Hampshire. She didn't mention his time at Harvard in the anti-musical department there, which, of course, gave you a certain foundation. But in the end, to me, and having known him for many years, what he writes about and what he evokes is that he was a freewheeling child of the late 60s and what that stood for. And there is a part in the book which is a wonderful metaphor for what happens or what is happening in John's life, where he and his new wife set out in a beat-up old VW on a journey across America, final destination to be California, and they were seeking wonder and marvels and, as you read in the book, a good mechanic from time to time because the car keeps breaking down. But there are some wonderful passages, some very evocative passages. But another part of the pleasure for me, John, was the natural and continuous insertion, and going back to this thought of composing an American life, of American names. And what a collection. From Walt Whitman to Wallace Stevens, Emerson to Ellington, Ginsberg to Glass to the Grateful Dead, Copeland to Charlemagne Palestine, I don't know how many of you know him, Jimi Hendrix, Charles Ives, Henry Kissinger, Victor Herbert, and Milton Babbitt. And that's just a start. And somehow in your life, you've synthesized what is this sprawling American experience we share together, and you've turned it into a cradle. Of your artistic output. So some of you might say this is courageous. So much of what we do is often based on, unfortunately, on European models. So my question is, was it conscious? Was it conscious? And as you made this trip and these parallel trips, what were the discoveries or some of them along the way?
Well, I think the trip across the country is that's a classic American archetype. I mean, it is the metaphor, whether it's Horace Greeley saying "Go west, young man," or Jack Kerouac's characters with Neil Cassidy, getting in a car and taking this existential drive. There are this wonderful poems by Allen Ginsberg about crossing the Great Divide and arriving on the West Coast. In some ways, it's a parallel to the emigration from Europe to the East Coast, which started several centuries earlier. But I think it's a metaphorical voyage, but also it's a real voyage. It's a real voyage of physically moving from one part of the country to the other. It doesn't even have to be from east to west. The idea of the road movie, getting in that car and moving across the land is it stirs our American imagination, and it evokes images of the vastness of the land and the great variety of the culture. I mean, you give this list of names. Actually, when Hallelujah Junction was in its editing phase, one of the documents that I got, which was an amazing document, was just a list of all the names and the place names in the book. They just had sent it to me. Somebody had extracted it via a computer to make sure that all the spelling was right. And I found it amazingly evocative. It was like a poem by Gary Snyder or something. It had all these place names that I had mentioned. And I realized that in one sense that was my life, whether it was Concord, New Hampshire, or Lake Winnipesaukee, or Boston, or Reno, or Mendocino, or Los Angeles, and all these place names evoke they're like fractals. They evoke so many different associations in our memory, and that touches on the issue of what it means to be an American artist and why I'm so drawn to the Beats, Kerouac and Ginsberg. I don't think necessarily Jack Kerouac was one of our greatest prose stylists. I mean, I don't think he's out there with Hemingway or Henry James or Robert Frost or Whitman. But he expresses a sense of the quest and the richness of American life. And being an American artist, I think, is in part being very porous, being a big sponge, and being able to take things in. And I'm not sure that characterizes artists in other cultures. I think, for example, in Europe, particularly in the modernist era, the creative model was the opposite. It was one in which you said, no, that's been done, not that, not that, not that, not that, not that, until you've refined this kind of diamond hard essence. Whereas in America, we're sort of the opposite. We just soak it all up, Whitman style, and that in part is the image of Hallelujah Junction.
You want to read part of the book? There's a wonderful part where you finally come to San Francisco.
Oh yeah.
That now. That might be through that famous tunnel.
I should preface this just by saying that I did actually make the trip in a very seriously challenged Volkswagen Bug, which kept breaking down, and I had never been to the West Coast. This is 1971. All I knew about it was what I'd read in literature, and I'd listened to The Grateful Dead and The Jefferson Airplane, and I saw the movie Monterey Pop, which had Janis Joplin and Ravi Shankar. So my image of California was romantic. But when I actually arrived, I found that it was even more wonderful than I'd ever imagined. The first encounter with the far coast, the Pacific, and its remote landscapes had a numinous meaning for me. And I found I was ready to absorb the change and all its implications for my future. Behind me lay New England, familiar and comforting, where the landscape felt closed and closed in like a warm family nest. Here, on the other hand, the dome of the sky was more expansive, the sea more present, and the land more untamed and mysterious. I'd prepared myself for the trip by reading evocative descriptions of California coast by writers such as Robinson Jeffers and Henry Miller, Jack Kerouac, Allen Ginsberg, and Gary Snyder. But nothing could summon up the constellation of emotions and sensations this first encounter provided. In 2003, 32 years later, I would compose a work called The Dharma at Big Sur, a dreamlike vision of the coastline as homage to this moment of arrival. My first view of San Francisco was from the Golden Gate Bridge on a fresh, clean August morning when the world seemed exceptionally at peace with itself. Approaching the city from the north, one passes through a tunnel in southernmost Marin County that leads onto the famous bridge. To the southeast lies the city, clustered on the peninsula between the bay to the east and the Pacific to the west. It was one of those summer mornings that I would come to know and never cease to savor over the years. The nighttime fog cools the city and the bay as far as the Oakland Hills, only to burn off at midday, leaving the air and the land scrubbed clean and bathed in a shimmering, glad summer light. In 1971, you could still hear the long, plaintive moans of foghorns rolling across the nocturnal waters of the bay when the weather turned overcast. It was the mythic city of the gold rush, of Sam Spade, the Dharma bums, and the Grateful Dead. To me, so ready for a change from my New England confines, it looked every bit as lovely and inviting and congenially seductive as I had imagined it would.
So you arrived in California. You refer to California transplants. It's a wonderful phrase John uses. He says, grateful immigrants. Grateful immigrants, I being one of them. And there are so many of them. John, myself, Peter Sellers, Frank Gehry, Bill Viola, Esa Pekka Salonen, you, those of you who've emigrated. What I was thinking about, though, John, is a question. Emerson spends time trying to establish what he terms a new world sensibility. Is there a California sensibility?
Well, funny you should ask. I really don't know. And I think one thing is certain is that as we progress historically, we're finding that the society is becoming more and more homogenized. And I mentioned the great California historian Kevin Starr in this book, whose amazing five-volume History of California is truly one of the most revealing and enjoyable and brilliantly conceived histories that I've ever read. And Kevin mentions the philosopher Josiah Royce. I don't know how many people here, if anyone's even familiar with Josiah Royce. We have one person at least. Two, three, four. Excellent. Well, he was a positive logician, a philosopher who was brought to Harvard by William James, the great philosopher and psychologist back in the 19th century. But actually, Josiah Royce was born in a shack in the gold country in Grass Valley, California, and he was brought up. He actually enrolled in the very first freshman class there ever was of the University of California, and although he spent most of his life writing philosophical papers, he wrote about California, and he wrote he coined a phrase that I resonated with so deeply, which was the term provincialism. And by provincialism, he doesn't mean it in the pejorative sense that we're used to using it. He means it in a very positive sense. The idea of local flavor, local identity, that a region and a group of people can actually have a unique identity. And I keep using the word flavor. You find it in Bartok's music, you know, that it just feels so intensely Hungarian. I find it in George Eliot or in Dickens, that rural English trait in George Eliot or Thomas Hardy or the wonderfully comic or tragicomic Englishness of Dickens. But I could go on and on and on. In my hometown of Berkeley, we have this amazing old architecture by Julia Morgan and the architect Maybeck. Even Alice Waters, the cook and founder of Chez Panisse, has created a kind of local identity. And I think it's in danger that Californianess is in danger of becoming just kind of ironed out and diluted through, you know, the digital age, through the internet, through television, through media, through the fact that we all, you know, eat the same boring food and watch the same boring television and read the same boring newspapers, but that may not be for very long. And one might actually think about doing the opposite of really cultivating what's unique about one's community, whether it's Los Angeles and this marvelous library here and the amazing things that are going on up the street, or your own local community, you know, out in the suburbs. So I think that's where a lot of great art is born, that it's born locally, not internationally.
Well, this isn't in the book, but let's take a minute actually now to tell you a little bit about a look that you're trying to glance into what could be that California sensibility, or what it has been and could be, which is in the festival you'll be curating for the Los Angeles Philharmonic next year, West Coast, Left Coast. So maybe you'd tell us a little bit about
good.
That.
Good. Our plug time.
we'll take donations afterwards.
Well, Deborah and our wonderful artistic administrator, Chad Smith, approached me about creating and curating a festival of West Coast culture. I mean, essentially music, because it's the Philharmonic, and that's what we do. But to include an examination of the many different art forms that constitute some kind of West Coast sensibility. And I realize I'm stepping into, you know, perilous waters here, because it is very speculative. And of course, I've chosen to feature certain composers and certain writers and certain artists, and I fully expect, you know, to be accosted by people who are passionate about someone that I've never heard of, and, you know, why didn't you include so-and-so? And a festival can only be a sampler, and it has to become a kind of prejudiced personal sampler, which it is. But we're taking a very playful approach. Our concerts, well, I'll give you an example. One concert starts with a piece called U.S. Highball by Harry Partch, a composer who was an absolute cantankerous son of a bitch, just a real cranky maverick who, when the great patron, the late great patron Betty Freeman, discovered him, he was living in his car in Pasadena, but he did amazing things with alternate tunings, and he invented his own music. And so the Kronos Quartet is playing a piece that involves a narrator and very unique musical imagination. And then we're actually preceding that with a piece called Fog Tropes by Ingram Marshall, who for many years lived in the San Francisco Bay Area. And Ingram based his piece around just those plaintive, mournful foghorn sounds that I mentioned in that passage that I read. And And then I'm conducting the Los Angeles Philharmonic players for the second half of the concert in selections from The Yellow Shark by Frank Zappa. So that's one program. Another evening will feature jazz performers. Am I allowed to say whom, or we're still negotiating? Somebody like Charles Lloyd or Joshua Redman, possibly even them. And we've asked Michael McClure, who's one of the few surviving members of the Beat Generation, probably because he took the least controlled substances, to help us select poetry. And we're going to have some really great stage personalities come in and read classic text by Ginsberg and Gary Snyder, Diane DePrima, Gregory Corso, and Lawrence Ferlinghetti. That's one evening. Another evening, I'll be conducting the Philharmonic in a very mixed program that includes the film score to the movie Rebel Without a Cause, which was written by Leonard Rosenman. Gustavo Dudamel will be conducting the piano concerto that was originally written for Keith Jarrett by Lou Harrison, and Esa-Pekka Salonen's L.A. Variations. I think Esa-Pekka Salonen has stayed here long enough for us to consider him a California composer. So it's, you know, it's that kind of festival where we're just reaching out and just saying, well, this was done here, and it's not been done anywhere else in the world. And this is done here, and maybe it was done in New York, but it had a different flavor when it was done here.
And it will be a highlight of the season. Let's change gears a little bit. Maybe we'll come back to talk more about Creative Chair later on. I found it fascinating when you wrote in the book. I actually don't think I had ever read a composer writing about how they compose. I've sat with Esa-Pekka on many trips, on tours when he's composing, and so I've actually seen him do it because he composes a lot on a computer, and we talk about it, but I'd never actually read something about it. So one of the things I thought might be interesting for you to hear about, and if you read it in the book, which I highly recommend, you'll see even more detail, is to talk to John about how he does compose, and coming at the end to how you've been able to forge such a personal harmonic language. If we hear Mahler, we know it's Mahler. If we hear Beethoven, we pretty much know it's Beethoven. And if I hear Adams, I know it's Adams. Is there a schematic? Is there a plan? Is there a eureka moment? How does it happen? It's mysterious to us.
Well, you know, I've always felt that a great artist, and not just a composer, but anyone who's a really in-tune artist where things are happening, is operating both above board and below board, that your conscious brain is operating, but at the same time your unconscious brain is operating. And when things go wrong, one of those states tends to dominate. And it's interestingly enough, it's usually the conscious state that's tyrannizing the unconscious state. The great psychologist Jung talked a lot about this, talking about the feeling function and the thinking function, the sensation function, and the intuition in his theory of types. And I think he had a point there about how the mind, I won't even call it the brain, because I think it's such a complex of the emotions and the intellect and the senses, hearing something that's beautiful and gets a buzz. And so you kind of function in this zone that's it's not exactly a fragile zone, but it's a zone that can be easily interrupted, which is why composers they're very habitual people. Now, there's some composers that can't compose unless there's a lot of noise going on. You know, there. I think Schoenberg was that way. He always had racket going on and family and kids chattering and things like that. And then there was Mahler, you know, who had to have his isolated hut and couldn't bear the thought of anybody interrupting him. So each person is different, but you have your ritual and you have your habit, and that those habits are there because you have to maintain that balance between the unconscious and the conscious. I think for me, what generates a piece usually is finding the right combination of a harmonic locus and a rhythmic cell. And the way to do that is you basically improvise. I don't think I've ever had a generating idea by just sitting at a table. I mean, I've always had to bang on something. Either it was a piano or, you know, a synthesizer, or I know other composers. I know one composer who has his guitar hooked up to his laptop, and he gets his ideas by improvising on the laptop. I think that most of the 19th century composers just improvised at the piano. We know, for example, that Chopin improvised all his piano music, and he would play the pieces over and over until he knew exactly what the piece was, and then he would commence this incredibly arduous and painstaking procedure of writing down exactly what he had played. Stravinsky banged on the piano. You can tell because Stravinsky's music, even when he's writing for the voice, it sounds like the piano. It's just kah, kah, kah. It always has that hard edge and that wonderfully vibrant sense of energy. I'm very motivated by words, so needless to say, when I get a good text, as I did in the librettos that Alice Goodman wrote for me, the combination of words and an image, whether it's Richard Nixon arriving on the tarmac in Peking and coming down off out of the plane to shake all these Chinese party officials, or whether it's the tense hours leading up to the explosion of the first atomic bomb, those mental images also suggest musical images.
You've been asked and are asked on a regular basis to create compositions for moments of importance, the sort of moments of state, moments of humanity. For us, in Los Angeles, you wrote a piece for the opening of Walt Disney Concert Hall, the Dharma at Big Sur, and there's sort of an amusing part of the book where John writes about that, and where we had some difficulty with the balances, because even though we had, as we call it, tuned Walt Disney Concert Hall to within an inch of its life, that tuning had only to do with acoustical sound. And in fact, it took us many years to figure out how to start to deal with amplification. And your partner, Mark Gray, who's just such a great, great sound designer. But John was asked to produce a piece, and he did for the opening of Walt Disney Concert Hall for Gustavo Dudamel's inaugural concert. Very important moment for us. We've also asked John to create a piece, to write a piece, City Noir. And you'll hear that next October. But there was another moment.
If you can get a ticket.
Yeah, if you can. We're doing it a couple of times. Or you can come on tour with us, because we're taking it on tour nationally as well. But after September 11, 9/11, the New York Philharmonic asked you to write a piece about 9/11, and you produced Transmigration of Souls, which I think is a piece that will have a very long life, and we listen to it now away from the context of 9/11, although it is absolutely about 9/11. And now I just listened to it recently, and you hear it in a completely different way. And in fact, it's a piece that's being performed many times. But how do you respond from these really situational kinds of commissions, aside from getting, I guess, maybe scared? I don't know. What's it like?
Well, it's a burden. But it's a burden that you take because, I think that classical composers over the last 50 years have become, they've sort of fallen off the radar. People don't care much about them because so much of what they wrote was self-referential and inaccessible and you know, very, very sincere audiences who really wanted, you know, to be part of the contemporary music experiences were left befuddled, or worse, they felt intimidated by, you know, a style of music that was very dissonant and very complex and very inaccessible. And I was always inspired by composers and authors who felt that they had a major role to play in the culture, and whether that was Wagner or Tolstoy, or, you know, for that matter, Goethe, certainly, you know, Stravinsky, people who actually did see their life's work as something that could speak to a large audience. Now, not the proverbial man in the street. I expect that my audience is musically literate and knows the reference points. I need my audience to know Stravinsky and to know Beethoven and to know Sibelius and also to know Duke Ellington and, you know, the Beatles. So if I get a commission, and I, you know, an example that Deborah mentioned, the Transmigration of Souls is a work that I wrote for the New York Philharmonic. I was asked with very short notice to write a piece to commemorate the first anniversary of the World Trade Center attacks, and I absolutely did not want that commission. Before I got the phone call, a few people jokingly said, well, you know, is Adams going to write this piece? Sounds like something he would write. And I just blanched at the thought, because it seemed that the only way you could do something like that would be in very poor taste. Then I got the request, and it was a very genuine, very sincere request. The Philharmonic players had gone down to, you know, Ground Zero, and they'd performed for the workers, and many people in New York that I know had been profoundly emotionally scarred by the event. And I knew that I had to find a way of writing this piece. And I took it upon myself kind of as a civic duty to be able to do that. Fortunately, I can say that the piece I'm writing for Gustavo that will be done in October on the first subscription concert, I'm honored, and that I when that subject came up, I immediately said yes, and I'm very much looking forward to it. Although I have to say that it never gets any easier, it's still scary. You want to, with each new piece, you want to say something new. You want to take risks. You don't want to fall back on surefire effects. But at the same time, it sort of has to work. You don't want an international telecast and, you know, every music critic on the planet coming to hear a piece that's a flop.
Yes, it's going to be heard not just in the United States, but in throughout Europe and Asia and South America. So, we'll keep our fingers crossed. Okay, names, titles. My Father Knew Charles Ives. The Dharma at Big Sur, Hoodoo Zephyr, Guide to Strange Places. I remember when you first said, well, you're going to do an opera and call it Nixon in China. That seemed far out to me. Dr. Atomic. We can go on and on. How do you pick such cool names?
Well, I think Symphony in B flat is kind of boring. You know, it probably reflects my literary bent. I love to use words, and I'm very fond of composers and novelists who have great titles. I mean, Frank Zappa had great titles, and you know, maybe it goes back to, you know, the late 60s when you had bands called Disraeli Gears or the Strawberry Alarm Clock or We Americans do like to play with images and words. So also they're evocative. I think that with a title, if you can have a title that in itself is sort of artistic and gets the mind going, that it adds to the pleasure of experiencing the piece.
I agree. I mean, they're fun and they're you. I mean, they're not contrived. They're so John Adams. It's a wonderful thing. Well, tomorrow night we're doing actually a piece that has a rather modest name, A Flowering Tree, and it's there's actually a chapter about it in the book, which is called Tree of Life. Although I have to say, when we were walking over tonight, what it reminded me of was our first flowering tree experience, which was one of my very first jobs in music was that I was an assistant manager at the San Francisco Symphony, and I was the producer of John's very controversial and very wonderful New and Unusual Music series. And so we wanted to go to different cool locations, and we'd found a sort of warehouse called the Galleria, and it was actually a showcase for, far-out furniture. And this concert took place around December 1st or something, and so everything was really great. And then we got there, looked just so, this is hip, this is cool, people will go here. We got to the first rehearsal, and in the middle of this warehouse, there was an enormous Christmas tree just planted right in the middle, and I'm talking, the size of this stage. And we worked with a very supportive friend of ours, great supporter of John's, Ado de Vart, but he was a very grumpy Dutchman, really grumpy. And I remember we didn't know if that concert would happen, so that was our first flowering tree. But now this is a happier flowering tree. And it also represents a group of very sort of touching intersections, because John wrote the piece, the opera, Flowering Tree, for Peter Sellers and the New Crowned Hope Festival in Vienna, which had to do with the 250th anniversary, actually commemorated, of Mozart's birth, and the inspiration was the magic flute. But the texts are in Spanish, and in fact, you went to Caracas to work with the Scala Cantorum and to work with musicians from El Sistema, and there you meet the very young Gustavo Dudamel. So maybe tell us a little bit about, because that was a pretty wild experience, your trip down.
Well, it was a very strange a sequence of events, because Peter Sellers had been asked to direct a festival, a sort of alternative festival in Vienna that was keyed to the 250th anniversary of Mozart's birth, and I was conducting the London Symphony Orchestra, and Peter came backstage to say hi during intermission, and he brought with him the great English conductor, who's a dear friend of both of ours, Simon Rattle, who is now the conductor of the Berlin Philharmonic. And Peter, in his usual effusive way, was telling us about this festival, and he said, "And I want to commission works that have something to do with the last year of Mozart's life." And without even thinking, I said, "Oh, well, I want to write the Magic Flute, because I'd love the opera, and I wanted to write my own take on it." And Simon said, "Well, I'd love to perform it with my orchestra." So here you have these three extremely irresponsible middle-aged men without their minders, making irresponsible plans without their calendars or anything. And the next thing you know, we were hoping to do this. And then, one thing led to another, and the Berlin Philharmonic just couldn't make it work. And I went to Venezuela because I'd been told that there was a wonderful youth orchestra down there. And so I was picked up at the Hilton in Caracas by four very handsome young Venezuelan guys in their early 20s. They were all dressed in suits with wraparound sunglasses, and I wondered if I was actually being kidnapped. And we got in a car and went out to this, what's called El Centro, the musical center, which is where the Simón Bolívar Orchestra rehearses. And I tell you, they rehearse. They rehearse 5-6 days a week for 3 hours a day after school, and they have a young kids orchestra and a you know, middle orchestra, and then of course the big orchestra. So first I went to hear the Orquesta de los Infantiles, which was an orchestra of kids about between the ages, I'd say about 6th grade and 10th grade or so. And they played the blazing, red-hot, steamy Bacchanal from Samson and Delilah for me. And as I sat there, they played, and of course they knew it. Nobody ever looked at the music, and they kept stealing looks at me, you know, because I was this famous composer from up north. And then the godfather, who is also the patron of Gustavo Dudamel, whose name is José Antonio Abreu, who is kind of a godfather-looking guy with very thick glasses and always dresses and sort of sunken into these black overcoats.
Yeah, he looks a little like Yoda also.
Yeah, he's sort of a cross between Marlon Brando as the godfather and Yoda. And he's kind of a saint. He's a very savvy saint who knows how to deal with politicians, and he's survived all kinds of right-wing and left-wing dictatorships and continued to promote musical education in Venezuela. And they said, and now we have something a little special for you, John. And they brought me into this room, this very large room, where there were about 300 people, including a gigantic orchestra and a chorus of 200 people. They were all there at 10 o'clock on a Saturday morning to play for me. And then out came this handsome young guy with really curly hair and a T-shirt and jeans. And I thought, oh, they're going to do Mambo or some Venezuelan folk song suite or something like that. And this young guy, as you might imagine, was Gustavo Dudamel. He gives a downbeat, and I hear the strings tremolo on C minor, and I knew exactly what it was. It was the Mahler Resurrection Symphony. And so for the next 85 minutes, I listened, and I had my own personal performance of the Mahler Resurrection Symphony by Gustavo Dudamel. So I felt that I had launched quite an amazing friendship, right?
You did, but John, you're asked. I mean, you're asked all the time to take these positions, and I mean, I asked you once at the St. Paul Chamber Orchestra, and came back to you many years later. You have such demands on you because of your composing. Maybe this is an unfair question, but what was your hope that made you say yes to this?
I don't know. I keep saying I'm not going to do it anymore. You know, that I've been leading a double life, actually a triple life in a way, because I view myself as a composer, obviously, number one. But I love conducting. I love performing. You know, just this afternoon we had a 3-hour dress rehearsal with the Philharmonic and the Master Chorale, and it's just an extraordinary experience to work with human beings that are so finely tuned and so sympathetic and so virtuoso. I could never give that up. But then, you know, people ask me to curate and to put together festivals and things like that. And when I have people that I can bounce ideas off with, such as you and Chad and the people at Carnegie Hall, the wonderful creative staff there, Ira Gusalemian, among others. You know, they're people that I just have wonderful chemistry with, and the idea of putting festivals together and doing programming, I feel is a responsibility in a way, because classical music, I have to say this, it sounds rather harsh, but it really is true. Classical music audiences are the most timid of all art consumers, of all people who consume art, though, you know, whether it's reading a novel or going to see a dance, or when you go to the museum, a lot of people go to just modern art museums. They expect something new. And classical music people, largely I think because music goes straight to the feeling function. You know, in many ways it bypasses the rational part of the mind. I mean, you actually have to sort of make an effort to draw the rational part of the mind in. And then that, of course, you know, increases your pleasure tenfold. But music, unlike the other arts, goes directly to our emotions and our feelings. And for that reason, I think that's part of the reason why people are timid or conservative, because they really do want to hear something that's familiar. And if you go to a concert and the first thing you hear is something that's really aggressive and dissonant, and you don't know, you're not a composer or you're not a connoisseur of contemporary music, it can be a very, very profoundly upsetting and unsettling event. So what I'm trying to do is help by making programs that put things in context, that draw in unusual repertoire, that educate people and charm them and seduce them and make an artistic experience that sort of grounds you and lets you know where you are. And so that's why I keep saying yes.
And we're glad. We're glad. One last question, then we'll open it up to all of you, which is your book ends on such a hopeful note, and you should know that within the music world, we all see John as such a positive force and voice, and it's very inspirational to us. But the hopeful vision that you end with is you talk about your son Sam, who's incidentally also a composer. So the Adams family could, instead of presidents, also produce many composers now, potentially. The positive vision at the end is summed up by what Sam has on his portable hard drive.
Well, it was just a way of sort of summoning up how young composers are different than you know when I was a kid, and Brahms, the only way Brahms could hear a new piece was either to travel to another city to hear some symphony play it, or he could play it in an arrangement for four-hand piano. I mean, that's basically how all symphonic music was circulated in the 19th century, and God knows what being exposed to new music was like before that. It must have been very hard. And now, in my age, when I was growing up, I had the long playing record, and that vastly expanded my ability to hear music over, let's say, what my father or my grandfather might have heard. But even so, if I wanted to hear music from Bali or from Sri Lanka or from, Brazil, I would have to probably travel to Boston to an anthropological museum and listen to an old folkways record or something like that. Nowadays, it seems like everything from everywhere in the world is available within a matter of minutes, as long as you have a high-speed internet connection. But I did, the last chapter is called Garage Sale of the Mind. And, it was it's an amusing chapter where I talk about the idea of whether music actually evolves, whether it moves historically in a sort of Darwinian sense or whether it just simply is varied. And I talk a lot about the wonderful writer on evolution, Stephen Jay Gould, who actually thought that people misunderstood Darwin, that species don't evolve, they simply vary. And he points out that, the most successful organism, in the known world is the bacterium, which hasn't had to evolve at all because it gets the job done. I did mention my son's iPod. Let me see if I can find it here. It was just... I said I recently spent a summer evening with my son Sam, who's about 24 now, while he played me selections from his enormous library of music he carries on a small portable hard drive. In the course of several hours, he took me through a sample of what on that particular day was at the foreground of his musical consciousness. The list included sonatas and interludes for prepared piano by John Cage, ritual gagaku court music from Japan, some studies for player piano, by the maverick American composer Conlon Nancarrow, a work for chorus by the young British composer Thomas Addis, part of an astonishing Klangfarben instrumental work called In Vain by an Austrian composer, George Friedrich Haas. My son's got rather hardcore tastes. some Maghreb rap songs from Marseille. Two recent compositions by the jazz composer and saxophonist Wayne Shorter. Several electronica compositions by Aphex Twin and Square Pusher. And his most favorite piece of all, the Sibelius Seventh Symphony. And, you know, he's not alone. A lot of young composers have that frame of reference. It's got its good sides and its bad sides. I'd say the good side is that, you know, this sort of exclusive mindset that even John Cage had, you know, can't do this, can't do that, can't do that, it's already been thought of, has given way to a very kind of Catholic, open, as I said, porous point of view. On the other hand, the danger is that, you know, young composers will be just so filled with everything that they will have trouble forging their own individual voice. So it's a both, it's a, you know, a two-sided issue with both good and bad.
As is so much. Okay, I think this is the moment. We have microphones here, and if people have questions, I think John will try to answer them. And there's Mr. Microphone. Yes, right there.
So how do you counsel your son?
Pardon?
How do you counsel your son on his creative process?
How do I cope with my son?
Counsel.
Counsel him. Encourage him. Give him guidance.
I think kids that have really strong personalities and real desires to establish themselves, they don't come to parents for help. You know, I mean, he's obviously gotten a lot from me sort of sideways. You know, when he was a little kid, I, of course, gave him a lot and made sure he practiced and suffered all the, you know, the brickbats that one has to go through to see a kid through anything, whether it's sports or, you know, SATs or playing the piano. As they reach teenage sensibility, I don't think he ever wanted to reject me, but I think he really was concerned that he wouldn't, you know, go into life as the son of John Adams, that he would, you know, be his own self. And I know he went through a very, very hard period and even gave up music because he felt that there was no way around that juggernaut. And then some astonishing thing happened. I don't know what it was. I guess he realized that he really was somebody unique and special, and maybe he thought realized his dad wasn't so great after all. I don't know, but I'm very thrilled by that. And you know, I suspect Bach was probably a pretty good father because he had children who went on to be really wonderful composers. And if it weren't for the fact that their father was J.S. Bach, they would be even more famous.
Question there.
What is on your iPod?
Oh, it's so boring. I'm always asked that question. I hate to answer it because, you know, I feel like somebody looking in my closet and saying, God, don't you ever wear anything interesting? I'm a big fan of audiobooks. I'll tell you what I have. I have slogged through three late Henry James novels this year. And I want a medal right now. So I had, you know, I would read them, and then when I was, each morning when I walked the dog in the park, I would listen to a passage that I read because, it, you know, late Henry James is tough stuff. And so I still have Wings of the Dove and The Ambassadors and The Princess Casamassima, which isn't so hard, but it's a wonderful book. I have Jose Saramago's Blindness, and I have, I shouldn't even admit this, but I downloaded something called The Listener's Bible, because I'm interested in writing a sequel to my work, El Nino, and I wanted to listen to the New Testament on my audio, on my iPod, and it's a really strange thing because it's got somebody who talks about Jesus like this, and it has strange New Age music in the background, and I love it. So I come back from a rehearsing the LA Philharmonic, and I lie down in my hotel room and listen to Jesus. But I also have some music on it too.
Okay, some other questions? Are you going to go? Okay, right down here. I was looking for this side of the room here, but
do you write every day?
Yes, I do. When I'm not traveling. And I don't think that's a great thing. I really think that taking a couple of days off every week is a good idea. I tend to take days off sporadically because something gets in the way. So it doesn't have the pleasure of, it's Sunday, I'm not going to work. But I travel so much and I do, I'm gone more than I wish I were, so that when I'm home, it's actually, it's a thrill to be able to compose. In fact, I was recently saying to a friend that something has gone wrong when I actually feel guilty composing, because there's so many other people that want something and, pulsating, throbbing emails that haven't been answered. But I think that artistic creation is very much like being an athlete, that if you're in shape and you do it every day, it becomes, I won't say effortless, but it becomes much less stressful than if you don't do it and only go at it sporadically.
There was a question here.
Would you say something about your relationship with Peter Sellers?
There's not time. buy my book. I think Peter Sellers, and I'm sure that Deborah will agree with me, is just one of the most extraordinary human beings on the planet. He's such a warm and open and supportive person. He is this amazing soul who can inspire people. He's funny. He doesn't make things himself in the sense that I make something out of nothing. His real gift is planting a seed in someone, whether it's a video artist or a composer or a choreographer or even a writer. And the other thing that's remarkable about Peter is he's such a deep reader. I love to read poetry with Peter because he just goes so deep into the text and understands them at on such a level that just leaves me dumbfounded. And I feel very privileged. I love him dearly and thought that I've been able to work with him for 25 years now and we're continuing to dream up new projects. As I said to him the other night, you're the sunshine of my life.
it's an amazing kind of moment when, well, first of all, there are the intersections between you and Peter and Esa-Pekka, but one of the great experiences is interviewing Peter Sellers, because the knowledge that he contains within that wild hair, I think it's all up at the tips there, but it's, all you have to do is say, you need to prepare one question, and then you just sit there mesmerized for the next 45 minutes and upbeat lives before our concerts. We could go for hours. It's wonderful. Yes, right here. This lady right here.
Have you done much work with children and composing and contemporary music?
I have not composed pieces for children, and I feel ashamed that I haven't, because it's a unique thing, and it's something that only certain composers have been able to do, but great, great composers. For example, Schumann. You all know the album for the young and those many, many beautiful works by Schumann. Bartok. I mean, Bartok wrote the Microcosmos and the violin duos. Bach, of course, wrote the Notebook of Anna Magdalena Bach, and even the Well-Tempered Clavier, which we all know is hard as hell, was written as an educational piece. So it is writing for children, writing for young people is something that takes great imagination and invention. It looks like your question isn't done. Sorry.
Yeah, take the microphone.
Did
I misunderstand you?
No, that's part of it. But have you personally worked with children to talk to them about composing or about this music?
I see. Oh, sure.
The other one, too.
Yeah. Well, of course, I had kids, and I took them through both my daughter and my son, through Suzuki. And I talk about Suzuki in this book. I think he gets a bad rap. Because, people have seen the sort of negative side of Suzuki teaching, or maybe bad Suzuki teachers, of which there are some. But I read the book by Suzuki, who's, for those of you who don't know, he was a great Japanese pedagogue, and he instituted what's called the Suzuki system of teaching, which is basically piano and violin. And his idea, which I think was a brilliant idea, is that everyone speaks their language that they grew up with perfectly. I mean, okay, maybe once in a while we use me instead of I. Even Barack Obama does that. But he made this amazing realization. I'm speaking as if I were Suzuki. I speak Japanese perfectly. I, John Adams, speak English pretty much perfectly. So do you. Why couldn't a person play an instrument perfectly if they were brought up with the same exposure to playing and listening to how something's done and imitating it? And so he developed a program that's very much geared towards listening and imitating. It has the downsides because it doesn't emphasize reading as much as other systems do. But I learned that kids figure out reading later on, and I think it's a very successful system. So I've worked with kids. We have a wonderful school in Berkeley where I live called the Crowden School, and it's from ages fifth grade through ninth grade. And I go over there whenever I can, and I work with the students, not just composing, but I conduct the kids' orchestra, and they never laugh at my jokes. they all look at each other like, they're terrified. But it's really amazing if kids are really exposed, and let's say more than exposed, if they're submerged in music, how immensely gifted almost all of them are, and how they just absorb and then reproduce.
Okay, two more questions. They've got somebody right back there.
How is it different to hear your own music in Disney Hall?
Well, there are two ways in which it's different. One is it's acoustically a wonderful hall. It has a terrific bass resonance. Some halls don't support the bass. And for those of us who grew up listening to boom boxes and rock and roll, we want that bass. And Disney Hall has a great bass response. And then it's just a remarkable social experience, whether you're in the hall, in the audience listening, or whether you're on the stage performing, there's this marvelously intimate feeling of the connection between the audience and the performers on the stage. And, I can think of many halls where that is emphatically not the case. For example, the Avery Fisher Hall in New York. You've got the New York Philharmonic, which is a supremely, pardon me if I say this, but a supremely great orchestra. I'm joking because
Oh, I agree.
Deborah
totally
used to be the executive director of that orchestra. And it's like moving, from the Yankees to the Dodgers. But, you know, the New York Philharmonic is a great orchestra, but it's hard to tell that because the hall just doesn't support the sound, and it's not a nice experience to be in the hall because you just see the front row of the musicians. But here at Disney, the sight lines are wonderful, and the acoustical experience is so warm.
And the audience is a different audience. It's been molded throughout, I mean, a 17-year tenure of a composer who also happens to be our conductor. One last question. Okay.
I want to hear from a left winger.
Thank you. Well, first of all, it's an absolute amazing honor to be able to sit here and listen to you,
thank you,
talk about things. And ever since hearing Shaker Dance accidentally, it's been an amazing journey Shaker Loops, to hear you talk. Your references to literature are really fascinating, and when you mentioned 9/11, it got me thinking that there are writers who talked about how fiction no longer seemed relevant. They wanted to go into nonfiction, and sometimes vice versa. And I'm just wondering if you think in music, do you have that opportunity? Are you sometimes thinking in terms of writing fiction versus nonfiction music?
Wow, that is that's quite a question. I never thought of that. I mean, I think that the great bifurcation in music is between pop and classical, and I talk quite a bit about it in the book, about what it's like to be a classical composer in a society where popular music and popular culture in general has enormous prestige. You know, you can't run for office without saying how much you like, you know, Kanye West or, you know, Willie Nelson or something. And, you know, if Barack Obama or John Kerry, God forbid, had said that they liked Beethoven, their poll numbers would have dropped through the floor, because this country is so, we have this suspicion about culture that there's something vaguely subversive and morally lax about art. And so that's why we really glorify pop culture. And it's all part of our, you know, we were a country that was founded by religious zealots and venture capitalists, you know, which is basically what the Puritans were, and the first colonists. So that lingering anti-intellectualism has great presence in America, and we composers and poets and serious novelists, we have to cope with that, and we have to find a way to sort of navigate through the shoals of a culture of who are on one hand really are genuinely would love to know, would love to be initiated, would love to get access to what it is we're thinking about, but at the same time are sort of a little bit intimidated. And whenever they look at the media, they never get anything. I mean, I don't know about you, but we get 120 channels on our cable, and there's nothing, absolutely nothing on any of them that has anything to do with our life. You know, you never see a poet. You never see a classical musician. You might see a sautéed kidney, you know, on an NPR cook show, or some masterpiece theater with a British accent, but that qualifies as culture. And so it's quite an experience to try to create great art in this culture. On the other hand, I wouldn't trade any other country for it.
Well, I think pretty soon we're going to close up shop so that John can sign some books. And, you know, I think you raise, I mean, there's so many wonderful points that you raised tonight, but I know one of our dreams and one of the things that we hope for as you work with us in the upcoming years is how can we return intellect and music specifically more to the central discourse of our nation? It's a worthwhile challenge. And I just want to thank you for being in my musical life since my 20s.
Well, thank you, Deborah.
Different exciting things you've shown me. And as we go tonight, I'm sort of shameless in this. I'm usually the pitch person for the Los Angeles Philharmonic, but tonight I'm going to ask you for something else, which is to really think about giving something to the library. This is a wonderful series. We all know these are difficult times, but it's our job in any way that we can to make our own contribution to that. So if you could think about that, I know the library would appreciate it very much. And thank you all so much for being here.
Aloud Audio is presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles and made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the Annenberg Foundation, City National Bank, contributors to the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and Donna and Martin J. Wolf. Media support provided by KUSC 91.5 FM and KCET. Aloud theme composed by Larry Karish.